It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Joined today, and thank you, by the way, for joining us for the Thursday edition of what's usually a Tuesday edition of our podcast, but you'll understand why. We're joined today by one of the most trusted and respected voices in all of journalism. He has written another book that I believe is destined to be yet another New York Times bestseller. He has a handful of them. This one, at least for my money, I'm going to lay aside the one about his son. I thought this book was fascinating. Thought I knew a little bit about this topic, but it turned out I did not. His name is Brett Baer, and you're sitting there thinking what I'm thinking. He's already one of the busiest people in the entire world, and he's a scratch golfer, and he's a father and a husband. How does he have time to write a deeply researched book about the origins of our country? And I'm going to ask him that. But first, Brett Baer, welcome. I'd be crazy to not get your reaction to the two dominant stories right now. Number one, what's happening in the Middle East. And number two, the fact that the House of Representatives doesn't have a speaker.
Yeah. Trey, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me. I think, first of all, I've just been anchoring, did a couple hours each day with Dana in the morning because Bill Hemmer was off. And so, you know, real time coming in, these video feeds, these interviews with family members that have been ripped apart, with people who have lost loved ones or are being held hostage in Gaza, and the stories that just tear your heart out, visceral reactions as they are dealing with what is just horrific to describe, but you have to describe it. You can't look away from it because it's really important that the world learns what this was. This wasn't soldier on soldier. This was terrorists on family, terrorists on civilians, terrorists on babies in some cases. And so I think this is the story of our time, really. I don't know where it's going to go. I think that the Israeli operation to rid Gaza of Hamas is going to be ugly and very public, and the world is going to have to buckle its seatbelt because I think we're in for weeks of really tough stuff. So that's one story that I really think is there's no moral equivalency here, and I'll be interested to see how the world reacts when this operation gets underway. The other story is a house that's frozen. I do think the situation in the Middle East changes the dynamic, and I believe that they're going to get their house in order, no pun intended, in this vote this week. And if they do, they can put this behind them, but it's not a good look organizationally or to run the government what happened the way it happened.
You know, Brett, as you are apt to do, you put your finger, I think, on the pulse of the country. No matter what else divides people, the notion that we're and we've seen some pretty prominent politicians like struggle with whether or not to side with terrorists or children who had their heads cut off. That's just not a close call. And I get that it's 99 to 1, but the 1% sometimes gets to disproportionate. I mean, Harvard, 30-something Harvard University in student-led groups, want to sympathize with Hamas. I just find it stunning. But
I agree.
Thank you for your insight on both of those. Now I want to move on to something that is happier, which is your brand new book, and you are a prolific author. How you managed to do that, I don't know, but you are. This is like maybe four or five, as I count them.
Six.
This one, six. Okay. Well, now you know I went to law school and didn't do well in math. I love motive. I, as any old washed up prosecutor does. I love to know what would motivate one of the busiest people in the world to write not just a book, but this book. And then I saw it, I saw it before I read the first chapter. These words, common ground, unifying, that was kind of your dedication, is to people who are interested in those two precepts. Why? Why are those two important to you?
Well, first of all, this process is a labor of love because I just got addicted to doing this. When I started this journey into history, it's my fifth presidential book. I started with Eisenhower, wrote about Reagan, wrote about FDR, Churchill, and Stalin, and those three books about the Cold War, the 3 days series. Then I wrote about Ulysses S. Grant. And this time I went backwards to the founding. I have a great team. I've got a researcher that's unbelievable that finds these nuggets, and then we kind of digest these things, and my co-author and I bounce back and forth. I spend a couple hours a night when I'm in writing mode with a glass of wine and a ping pong match with my co-author until we stitch together this quilt of this narrative that I think is very readable. And I've got the blueprint now that it's a little bit easier to do. All right. So that's the backstory of how I do it, why I do it. You're right. That dedication to finding common ground and unity, which is what George Washington really embodied. He did in the founding of our country. Arguably, we would not have a country, Trey, if it wasn't for George Washington. And I thought that in this time, when we're so partisan, so divided, it's important to remember that our country's been in really dark places before. And we've managed to come together in the toughest times and find a way forward. In 1876, Ulysses S. Grant held the country together from falling back into a possible second civil war. At the beginning of our country, we almost didn't have a country. People don't remember that after the Revolutionary War and the win against the British, the colonies were fighting with each other. They didn't agree on much of anything. The Articles of Confederation loosely held the country together, but they weren't working to the point that a lot of people said, you know what, it might be better just go back under British rule. That's the spot where this soda straw look at history, the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, and George Washington leading that, I think is important to look back to so that we can kind of look to the future.
You know, Brett, you put your finger on the importance of us knowing our own history. There is so much, I guess I'll include myself, but there's so much that Americans take for granted that, of course, things are the way they are, because what other way could they possibly have been? But you write about these points of contention back then that really did threaten this experiment in self-governance before it ever kicked off. If you were a journalist covering this, was there a point when you were writing this, or if you had been present, when you would have concluded, I just don't think we're going to make it?
Yeah, there were multiple points where they almost just punted and said, you know what, this isn't going to work. Let's just go back to the Articles of Confederation and see if we can stitch it together. They started this convention saying, maybe we'll just tweak what we have already. But they ended up going in there, very smart minds from different places, different backgrounds, and said, let's throw this out and build a new document, build a new government. And I say, you know, think about this. So George Washington is the head of this. After they get the Constitution and the formation of what it looks like, then they have to get it ratified, which is another major step as the rules that are written in the Constitution. And the fact that that happens, Washington calls it a miracle. But then he becomes the first executive, the first American president. There is no other person that puts a note in the desk saying, here's what you got to do. There is nobody passing the torch. He is the torch. And so makes the way that we understand the presidency is because of George Washington. And his most significant thing is at the end of two terms when he steps aside. And thereby, there wasn't any limit yet on terms, he could have stayed in power, but he chose not to. And the peaceful transfer of power is uniquely American. So I just look at this and in a narrative form, learning more about who Washington was. He really was a reluctant leader. He wanted to get back to Mount Vernon and to Martha and the farm, but he stepped up every time. And I think there's just a lot to learn about it in a narrative way that is not a history book. It's not 1,000 pages. You know, you could read it at the beach over 3 or 4 days. And I think come at the back end of it afterwards and say, I learn a lot about how we were founded.
No, it does not read like a history book. I mean, it is extremely well sourced. I mean, the footnote section is longer than most books I've read. it really reads more like a miniseries, like something that would be on Netflix or Hulu because of the characters. And I want to start with Washington, although he's certainly not the only character exposed in the book. Popular war and military hero. And then I sit there and think, this day and age, you know, quarter of a millennia later, I'm not sure that serving in the military is much of an advantage. I don't want to say it's a disadvantage, but I don't know that you get very high marks for having served. I wonder, have you ever thought about that and when and how that happened, that we would honor, look, we would have let him become king because mm-hmm. he was a war and military hero. We're going to talk about that in a second. But nowadays, I just don't know that there's any advantage to having served in the military. And that's kind of happened in your and my lifetime.
Yeah. I mean, fortunately, there have been people in the military who have stepped up and gone on to political positions. And I think we're better as a country for it because they have a unique perspective having served. But you're right. As far as an advantage politically, if we look at the people running for president on the Republican side, for example, the only person who served is Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. And you see time and time again, election after election, where that's not a critical thing. At this time, way back when, because of Washington's popularity after winning the Revolutionary War, he was, of course, the figure that everyone talked about, looked at, thought about. You know, you fast forward to Ulysses S. Grant. He was the figure after the Civil War that everybody circled around. Then you fast forward to World War II, Dwight Eisenhower. He was the winning general in World War II, and that's the figure everybody talked about. As you forward past that, and then you get into Vietnam, etc., it loses some of that punch about, you know, military figures and their political prowess. It may turn back, but right now you're right to point out that it's not the same as it ever was.
Yeah, I actually served with two people who were held POW for long periods of time. And I mean, you think about something that would stop me or you in our tracks. If we were to meet someone who was held as a POW, it just something seems to have changed. I want to ask you this about Washington. You wrote about his political allies and his opponents. What did you learn about who he partnered with, who he was at ideological loggerheads with, and how he may have interacted with his perceived political enemies or opponents?
Yeah, if he had a problem, it was not a personal problem usually. You know, he had disagreements with George Mason. He had, battles back and forth, but it was on substance. And he just comes off in all the writings, and this is not just from him, but from other people, as somebody who is somber, who is thoughtful, and is not a bomb thrower, is not somebody who's swinging for the fences. A lot of the other people at the time were. They were grandstanders, and he was not. You know, he worked with Hamilton, who was fiery, a great writer, orator. He was not. Thomas Jefferson, a fantastic writer who had a real problem with Hamilton, but he managed to work with both of them and put them in his cabinet and figure out a way to go forward. Ben Franklin was this jovial kind of figure who was well respected overseas, much different outgoing personality than George Washington, but they had a really interesting relationship that was, you know, very helpful to the forming of the country. And Madison, obviously, who was his closest ideological kind of friend and who really stirred this process forward of getting everything on paper and getting a government together.
You do touch upon Hamilton and Jefferson and their rivalry in in your book. And it was, I mean, you just laid out, they were very different. One was much more bombastic and overtly ambitious, and the other probably ambitious, but less so. I do wonder how Washington was able, I guess Reagan to a certain extent was able to do this too for those in our lifetime, but to get competing rival factions to maybe calm down a little bit for the betterment of the country, that's a gift to be able to do it.
Real gift. And, you know, we could use a lot of that now, you know, to listen first, to the other side. You may totally disagree with them, but listen to them. Let them say it. Let them do it. Say their piece. One of the things that I get from the whole experience is that we shouldn't be afraid of dissent. Dissent was baked into the cake of our founding, of our democracy, our representational republic. And dissent is good, but dissent balanced with union and eventually getting to a common ground is the best. And that's what Washington was exceptional at. I think that there are people in our country that are trying to do that, even though we're in this stir the pot, post on social media, you know, fire up the base kind of world. And if we can get to that understanding that dissent is fine, but eventually you got to get someplace, I think that would make us better.
You're listening to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. More of our conversation with the anchor of Special Report, Mr. Brett Baer, is coming up.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.
You use a word on the as part of the subtitle is exactly the right word, fragile. That just how fragile the piecing together of this country and the Constitution was, moving from the Articles. If you were sitting down with your children, or you were sitting down with other young people who just think, well, of course, I mean, we've always been like this. What else would we have been? What are some of the things you would point to say, we almost didn't make it? Mm-hmm. This was a point of disagreement that almost kept us from becoming us.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a big disagreement in the Constitutional Convention about states' rights versus federal powers, and what the balance was going to be. There was a big disagreement about representation in the government from big states and small states. And you would think, oh, that's been worked out. And no, that was a compromise that almost broke the whole thing up. I mean, Rhode Island versus Pennsylvania literally almost threw the whole thing into turmoil. But they figured their way through it. And they got the representation in the Senate, and they got the representation in the House. How the executive looked, there was a real concern about making sure it didn't look like a monarchy or sound like a monarchy. And, you know, the controversial part about the Constitution that people who really have a hard time looking back at history and say that we should change things, you know, slavery. Here's a document that deals with liberty. It's the greatest legal document in any country that provides liberty. And it's stood the test of time, but it's been under attack. And slavery is one of the things. You know, how can a document that talks about liberty talk about some people being 3/5 of a man? The founders knew that that was a problem. They debated it. They thought about it. But they knew they couldn't deal with it then. And they were going to have to deal with it later. Obviously, it took a lot later to deal with, but they acknowledged the disparity there. And finally, the battle about amendments. You know, there's 27 amendments, 10 of them the Bill of Rights. Finally, states said, I'm going to sign on to this only if we get this Bill of Rights. And fortunately, they did, because it really describes who we are as a people. So fragile is the accurate word. It was stitched together. Now, if you look back at it, there are different groups, Trey, who have since, in recent years, a progressive group, a conservative group, a libertarian group, looking at the Constitution, what would you change? The libertarian group says, we would say, we mean it at the end of the Constitution, basically. They wouldn't change a thing. The conservative group said, well, executive power needs to be more clearly defined and protected. The progressive group says the Electoral College needs to be scrapped. But for the most part, all three of those groups in modern day comes back to the same document that was hammered out all those years ago inside that room in Philadelphia. And I think that that tells you a lot about that document, the process, and where we are today.
Which is so amazing, Brett. It is so amazing that a document written that long ago would, and it's been amended, and appropriately so, and one amendment kind of undid one amendment, but really not that much, given what all that's transpired with technology and everything else in the world. It is stunning in a lot of ways that they were able, dare I use the word genius, that they were able to put this together. I want to let our listeners know, if you like history, and I'm thinking about my dad, he would love this because he loves history. But even if you're not a fan of history, if you're kind of like looking at where we are as a country today and want to know how we can navigate our way through it, this is the book for you. And so I want to ask you two more questions. You used the word fragile, which is exactly the right word for the time. But there are people listening, Brett, who think it feels sort of fragile today, that this experiment in self-governance, I mean, we see prominent political figures calling for a disunion, for secession, which I always found interesting because the state she represents went for President Biden. So I don't know what group she wants to secede to. But there are these calls for disunity. And I think your book can be a roadmap for how we get through these times today, not just what happened a couple hundred years ago. Do you agree that things sometimes feel fragile now?
Definitely. And I read about it at the beginning and the end of the book, and how, you know, that feeling is pervasive. And, you know, you just look at my Twitter feed or X feed and it can be a dark place, you know, depending on what we're covering that day. I usually, by the way, tell the people who say, you're so anti-Trump. And then the next person will say, you're so for Trump. You're in the tank. And I'll say, Bob, meet Sally. Sally, meet Bob. You guys work it out. But listen, I do think that it helps to look back in our history, and it helps to ground us that we've made it through some of the darkest times. The founding of our country, which honestly was on the edge, was not going to happen. We made it through that because primarily people like George Washington thought that there was a common good, that they could find a way through the differences. And I think that's a thread through all the leaders that I've written about. Arguably, Dwight Eisenhower is our most bipartisan president, working on a whole bunch of things with Lyndon Johnson and Sam Rayburn and others. You know, Reagan, stood for his principles, knew what he wanted, but also worked across the aisle with Tip O'Neill and others. FDR was sole, believed he was, you know, really the one that could get it done. But in forming of the war, worked with Stalin and Churchill. And Ulysses S. Grant arguably worked with everyone to try to hold the country together. So I think that is a common theme. It's why I started that Common Ground on my show, bringing Republicans and Democrats together to talk about what they're doing together, as opposed to always talking about what they're fighting about. So I think that there is a way forward to look at history.
Before I let you go, I have to ask you about the end, which was the perfect way to end. You closed the book with Washington's farewell. The humility of saying it's time to pick someone else. I just don't see that word humility practiced or, frankly, like really coveted among the electorate, like I wish it were. The humility to say my time is up, I'll pick someone else. What did you learn about Washington's character, the humility, and And is it still a trait we look for in our leaders?
Well, it has been waning as far as a trait in recent years, obviously. It was a big part of who Washington was. He always went into something saying, I might not be the best here. Just understand that. It was almost a preamble to taking the job, whether it was commander of forces or head of the Constitutional Convention or the first American president. I do think inside that farewell address, which, by the way, is read every February 22nd on Washington's birthday on the Senate floor, is a blueprint of very prescient look ahead. He was concerned about partisanship and political parties getting out of control and hurting the fabric of our country. Pretty forward leaning. On looking back then. He was concerned about the debt and overspending. He was concerned about getting entangled in foreign affairs to forget what we're doing at home. And, you know, Dwight Eisenhower's farewell address had echoes of George Washington's as well. I think that humble sense of service is something that we as a country could look to. And when time to go, it's time to go. Most recently, let's say, Senator Mitt Romney saying it's time for younger people to take this job. He could have done it for a number of different reasons, but it fits the mold of saying, you know, it's time to get other people in office. And we'll see. My hope is, Trey, that somebody reads these history books, and especially this one, and some kid somewhere says, you know, I want to be the next George Washington. I want to be the next Ulysses S. Grant. I want to be the next Dwight Eisenhower. And they use history as the guide to get there, because we could use a Washington right about now.
So well said. That would be great if young people would look to George Washington, who, near as I can tell, did not have an X account, Instagram, TikTok. If he did, I never followed him. The book, ladies and gentlemen, is titled To Rescue the Constitution, George Washington and the Fragile American Experiment. If you like history, this actually could be a textbook for a history class. But when I read it, it was much more about where we are today and how we get out of where we are today. That's the book. The author is Brett Baer, who's got a lot of other things going on, including an incredibly popular show at 6 p.m. on weeknights on Fox. Brett, thank you. Thank you for writing this, and thank you for loaning us a little bit of your time on our podcast.
Trey, thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Thank you all, and we will see you all next week. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts. And Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com.